Absolutely. And just opened my mind in a really big way. And he still is. Like, I still have so much to learn from him. And he actually lives in Nashville now too, so I get to hang out with him, and that's really wonderful. And yeah, just his approach, his singular sound is so special. I think having that as an example for me was really awesome. And I think it's like something that you don't necessarily figure out exactly how to do, but just the idea of sounding only like yourself is a powerful one, especially in the mind of a young person. It's like that's something to emulate. And he's got just such a deep understanding of music in general, and like a real love for all of it. So I think that's been cool too, because it's easy to just get narrow into something that you like and, be a specialist and dive deep, which is also so valuable, but then just remembering how much other stuff is out there and combining it in your own music and writing, I think is a great lesson.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman, which I hope inspires you through the personal stories of a diversity of musicians with in-depth conversations and great music that reveal the depth and breadth to a life in music. Brittany Haass is widely regarded as one of the most influential fiddlers of her generation. In this wide-ranging conversation, you'll be hearing about her early career, touring with her mentor Daryl Anger at age 14, the bands Crooked Still, Hawktail, and Punch Brothers with Chris Teeley. She reflected on the challenges and thrill of a touring life, the Nashville scene, her teaching through artists' works, and the dynamics of being a woman in bluegrass. We talked about mentors Bruce Malsky and Tony Trischka, her time at Princeton studying evolutionary biology, and the need for self-care and boundaries. We're featuring music from several of her albums, including her recent projects with sister Natalie and the Swedish musician Lena Jonsson. Like all my episodes, you can watch this on my YouTube channel or listen to the podcast on all the podcast platforms, and I've also linked the transcript to my website, leahroseman.com. The podcast theme music was commissioned from composer Nick Cold, and you can use the timestamps to navigate the episode. It's a joy to bring these inspiring episodes to you every week, and I do all the many jobs of research, production, and publicity. Have a look at the description of this episode, where you'll find all the links. Now to Brittany Haass. Hi, Brittany. Thanks so much for joining me here today.
Thanks for having me, Leah.
I have to say thanks to Joe K. Walsh for introducing us.
Yeah.
When I interviewed him for the podcast a few months ago, we finished recording and he said, Leah, you got to get Brittany Haass on this podcast. I'm going to introduce you. So I was delighted.
Oh, cool. He's awesome.
I thought it might be interesting to talk about the Valley of the Moon Fiddle Camp, where you spent some of your childhood.
Sure, yeah. It was a very formative place for me. I definitely credit it with the reason why I'm a musician today, because that was the first place where I kind of saw the music community in action, and it's also where I got to meet a lot of my heroes and mentors. Actually, both of my main fiddle teachers, heroes, mentors, I did meet there, Bruce Malsky and Daryl Anger, and Alistair as well, is like super influential just as a musician, but really the world that he's created there is such a special place. And I think now there's a lot more of them as the fiddle camp thing has kind of taken over the world. There's just lots of them because it's such a great place to meet and, share time and tunes and just have a good time around the music and meet people to play with. So yeah, it's super special. And I learned so much there. He's got a great way of bringing in different traditions. So it's not all just, it's called Valley of the Moon Scottish Fiddling School, but he always has three fiddle teachers from all over the world. So yeah, I was exposed to a lot of music, and you get to be near the people that you're listening to, and you get to watch them and hang out with them and talk to them. So yeah, it's wonderful. Can't say enough good things about it.
When I was looking at their website, I noticed that your sister Natalie's actually teaching there.
Mm-hmm.
And I had also read that your parents didn't kind of put pressure on you two to play together as children. It wasn't like a pressure situation.
No, yeah, they were. I think because neither of them, well, my mom did play some music. She used to play piano when we were first starting and doing Suzuki Method. She would play along. So she had, I think, a pretty musical ear. Like, she always loved music and had played a little bit here and there, but neither of them were really players. So they didn't have, I think, that sense of, kind of understanding like what we were going towards, or like that it could be a profession. So they were always just really encouraging of us having fun with it. And then that evolved over time as we got more serious with it. But yeah, we played for fun, but there was definitely none of the like stage parenting kind of stuff, because I don't think they even knew that was like an option. And we were also both very shy kids, so I don't think that was like a natural like progression for us, I guess. Like, it wasn't like, oh, these kids, like, they gotta be on stage. But we just love the music so much, so that was kind of the reason why it went that way anyways. But yeah, my parents have been very supportive in their own ways, and it's awesome. Very lucky.
Now, you and Natalie have very different and very busy careers, and I understand this recent album that you put out is mm-hmm. your first project like this together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been a long time coming. We've been busy doing different things, and she kind of went more down the Celtic route, and I was playing more American music, and she already tours in a duo with a Scottish fiddle player, which is Alistair. So that's her main touring gig, and they've been doing that for over 20 years now. So she's really busy with that, and they're such a classic sound that they've created together. So I guess I had in my mind that doing a duo project with her didn't really make sense, because she already had that, and it's such a paragon of what that can be. But then, yeah, we were just getting a few offers here and there from festival promoters that knew us both musically, and they said, can you do something together? And we said, yeah, that sounds fun, you know, it's a way to hang out. And she'd been writing a bunch of music, so there was stuff there ready to go, which was nice, because we kind of, when we first played together as adults and when we were teenagers playing gigs, we would just like play all the trad stuff that we'd learned at fiddle camp, which is a great wealth of repertoire to draw on. But I think it was more exciting for us to get to this place where we're at now, where we're trying to write our own music. And so that's the direction we're headed in.
And I noticed that I think some or all of the music's available if people want to buy the PDFs on your website.
Totally, yeah, on Bandcamp. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I wanted to shine a light on a few of your recording projects during this episode. So I was hoping we could use The Rose Gardener from this album, Hass.
Sure.
Do you want to speak to that tune at all?
So this is it's a waltz. And when I was writing it, I was kind of playing with the opening phrase. That's the idea, is that it's like it is in 3/4, but it's kind of playing against that with the way that the notes fall over the bar lines. So that was sort of how it started. And then I realized that I wanted to dedicate it to our mom. She's got an amazing rose garden that she's been working on for over 40 years. and yeah, it's just really special. I think she feels about gardening the way that we feel about music. So I don't know, I think the like emotion that like I was starting to pour into it, as it felt like the tune was like going in the direction that could support that, then it just felt like it was like made for her.
Aw, that's nice. You're about to hear The Rose Gardener from the album Hass with Natalie Hass. Thank you. I was just thinking, I mean, you're on the road a lot, and as a touring musician, a garden is one thing you can't really have.
Well, yeah, so I moved to Nashville about 12 years ago. I was in Boston before that, and I'd always lived in apartments with a bunch of folks and just, you know, like, lived there. But then I got to Nashville, and I'd always wanted a garden, I think, because it was in my blood from my mom. And because of the climate there and the humidity, it was just a little bit easier. And when I first moved to town, I was living with roommates still. And so I could, like, plant stuff and have other people care for it. So I kind of just got that going, and it went so well, I think, because of the high humidity and all that. Like, there's just tons of biomass getting created all the time, which also means a lot of weeding to do. But anyhow, I dipped my toe in there, and then I ended up getting a house where I still live now, and have just kind of like periodically made it more and more of a garden in the back and the front yards. And yeah, I'm not like tending to it very carefully. It's pretty wild, but some things come back on their own, and the winters aren't so harsh that they kill everything. And got a lot of flowers going and various fruit bushes and stuff like that.
Do you find it's a little bit like editing when you write music? Because something, you know, you think is really great, and then you're like, what if I just remove this whole bit? You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, yeah, totally. I think there's something to that, and that you just kind of have to let it take its own course, you know? Like, you don't really know what's going to work. You just throw a lot of seeds in, especially with my, like, take on it, where I'm like, I'm going to throw the seeds in, and then I'm going to leave for 2 weeks. So, like, the tough things survive, and I think it's like that with ideas, too.
Now, if we could go back to your youth. So your very first album, I listened to it a lot before I realized how young you were when you made it. So 20 years ago, you were 17.
Yeah.
This fantastic album.
Thanks.
With some of your mentors on it as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Daryl Enger produced it, who he was my teacher, and then he hired me in his band, Republic of Strings, when I was, I guess, like 14. And then it was his idea. He was like, you should make a solo record. And I was really obsessed with Bruce Molsky and just went, you know, head in on the old-time music, because I just loved how he sounded. And so all the repertoire on there is trad old-time tunes, but Daryl helped me with figuring out how to arrange it in, like, a new way. So he made a bunch of really cool chords, and then he would say, like, okay, I have this idea for, like, this instrumentation, and then there'll be a solo here, and can you write this bit for that? And so, yeah, it was a really fun process, and I can't believe it was that long ago, and everybody's like, why haven't you done another one? And I'm like, but, you know, other things happened, and I realized how much I like collaborating. So that's where I've been putting my energy since then, basically.
But the sound of that album is so rich with, like, low strings. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, bass, cello, guitar.
I think Mike Marshall's playing mandocello on it, like, and your sister's playing. Like, you just have this such a rich sound, and I don't think I've really heard another album like that with such a, and almost like some folk symphonic, but not at all symphonic, if you know what I mean. It's just
cool. Thanks. Yeah, that's an awesome take on it.
Would you be interested in us including any tune from that album?
Sure. Let's see, what would be a fun one? There's the kind of like the classic ones, but maybe something other than that. Let me just take a quick... Maybe Orly, that would be a nice one. Has a nice cello component.
Yeah. This is Orly from Britney's debut album called Britney Haas. Thank you. Now, Daryl, he's all about multi-style playing. You know, mm-hmm. you definitely can't put him in a pigeonhole. So he must have really influenced you in terms of your exploration of different fiddle styles.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. And just opened my mind in a really big way. And he still is. Like, I still have so much to learn from him. And he actually lives in Nashville now, too, so I get to hang out with him, and that's really wonderful. And yeah, just his approach, you know, his singular sound is so special. I think having that as an example for me was really awesome. And I think it's like something that you don't necessarily figure out exactly how to do, but just the idea of sounding only like yourself is a powerful one, especially in the mind of a young person. You know, it's like that's something to emulate. And he's got just such a deep understanding of music in general, you know, and like a real love for all of it. So I think that's been cool too, because it's easy to just get narrow into something that you like and, you know, be a specialist and dive deep, which is also so valuable. But then just remembering how much other stuff is out there and combining it in your own music and writing, I think is a great lesson.
So you mentioned Suzuki. Were you playing classical violin as a kid as well mm-hmm. as doing, yeah?
It overlapped for a little while. I started taking bluegrass fiddle lessons from Jack Tuttle when I was 8. And so I guess for about 5 years I was doing both. And then my violin teacher moved away and I met Daryl at the same time.
Okay.
And I kind of sought out a new classical teacher, but it just didn't really work out. And then Daryl took me on as a student, so then I just sort of went hard in the fiddle direction.
Yeah. And how did you went on tour with him when you were 14 with the Republic of Strings.
Mm-hmm.
Were your parents cool about that?
My mom came along sometimes, yeah. And she would, like, sell CDs and stuff. I think they just had so much trust for him. And, you know, knowing everybody in the band, and they're all lovely. It was a very safe situation, you know, and I think he was really conscious about it too, about like, how do I make this kid feel comfortable? And he did a great job with that. So I think it was easy for them to let me do that.
Mm-hmm. But yeah. Do you think there were challenges starting to work professionally so young?
Not that I saw until way later, I would say. Like, I think at the time I was just thrilled. And also really privileged that I was like going to a school that was really supportive of me going off on these musical adventures and mm-hmm. missing class here and there. I mean, I was a good student, so I think that helped. I was just kind of like a nerd, so I was like still getting my homework done. But I think I was very supported, I would say, like that my academic teachers thought it was cool that I was doing that, so they gave me room to explore that. Yeah, well, so I guess the first like thing to decide was like, am I going to go to college or not? And my sister is older than me, and she'd already chosen to go to Juilliard, so she kind of paved the way in my parents' mind of this whole like studying music or like being a musician as a career path. Because that was really foreign to them. Like, they saw that we were talented and excited about music, but they didn't necessarily know how to proceed with that. And my mom, like, was amazing and just, like, asked everybody, like, what do you think about Berklee College of Music? And, like, should my daughter do this? You know, and, like, just, like, really pooled all the resources available to her. And then Natalie went to Juilliard and did well there, so she kind of set that as a bar. And then when I said, like, I actually don't want to go to music school, my parents were like, are you sure? But yeah, I think I was not conflicted, but just I think I had the sense that if I went to music school, I would like stop loving it in the way that I loved it, because I had this very organic like mentor-mentee relationship with Daryl, and that was like so much of my studying happened in that scenario, which I'm like so lucky to have had that. So I think the idea of like going into a formal music school was just kind of odd to me, but in hindsight I think it probably would have been totally great too. But I got to go study other stuff and like keep my musical life going meanwhile. So then when I chose music it felt more like a decision than like a channel that I'd been plugged into since being a kid. But I think there is, it's still hard to not have it feel like you're just plugged into this channel, because the opportunities come very organically. It's like, this band needs a fiddler, or then you get this other gig. So I think as a sideman woman, like that feeling is common. This kind of like, you don't necessarily have control of your own life. You're just going with the opportunities that arise. But that's not necessarily a bad thing. And if you can figure out how to embrace that and kind of have your peace, your inner peace somehow, you know, like figuring out how to do the lifestyle. I think that was the big challenge for me later, was like, finished college, joined Crooked Still, well, had in the opposite order, but then like kind of went on the road full time with them. And there was me and Tristan were the young ones, but they're basically the same age, you know, like 5 to 8 years older than me. So yeah, just kind of like learning what it felt like to be on the road all the time. And I think it was so fun that I got a little bit like blinded by that part of it. And I didn't know how to seek balance. So I wasn't like filling my cup in the way that is necessary, I think, for everybody, but maybe especially for like creative types. So yeah, I think I just was like, woo, like this is so fun, and like we're just playing, and we would like go to festivals. I just jam all night long and just like play all the time. But I wasn't thinking like, okay, what's my next move, or like when am I gonna write another album, or you know, whatever. Like I didn't have my head in the game that way. I wasn't definitely didn't have any kind of plan for my future. And I still don't necessarily have that, but I think it became more apparent that I needed some more balance, that I didn't need to just like go after every single gig and fill every day and be constantly on the move. And some of that just came with aging, I think, like being like, oh, this is hard, this lifestyle, or like, wouldn't it be nice to like be home a little more and have friends that lived in my town, or like just kind of things that are like pretty obvious, I think, to people who are not touring musicians.
Yeah. I mean, you're giving me ideas for things. It's funny because I have some upcoming interviews in the next couple of weeks with people who are on the road like you a lot. Mm-hmm. And it's a world I don't know that well, because when I go on tour, mm-hmm. it's extremely limited. So, yeah. Well, but you did go to Princeton and study evolutionary biology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was awesome. I loved it. Learned a lot, met a lot of really inspiring people. And yeah, meanwhile, I was playing, and yeah, I had a really great experience there. And I think it sort of solidified my life choices, I guess, like the things that happened during that time. It was like, I'm sort of fighting this like pull to just be a musician. But I'm glad I had that like time to like do a normal like college experience. But then, yeah, it was like that was all my spare time, and all my social connections mainly were through music. Like I was always seeking that out, and I had a lot of cool, diverse experiences with that. Like I played in the marching band. I would like jam with these like just, you know, whatever, like people that just liked music, you know, that it wasn't just about fiddle music, because that was more rare there, but I could still seek that out. I started playing with Tony Trischka, who lived in New Jersey. I was going into New York City and going to jams and stuff. So yeah, it was a time where I think I figured out that music was probably for me.
Well, your studies in evolutionary biology, I was wondering if it influences, you know, you have this beautiful album Place of Growth with your band Hawktail.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and just the titles of the tunes and the whole organic feel of the album.
Yeah, I think that's related. And it was also coming from the other players in the band, and just that it was made during the pandemic. And that was something that we were all thinking about, like reconnecting to nature and being outside more, which we were really lucky in Nashville. That was easy to do. So I think we all kind of were more in that mindset. But yeah, that's definitely, it's always a part of my life, I think, like the way that I relate to the world, having had that training. And I'm really grateful for that.
So this is like your band in terms of not being a side player, Hocktail.
Yeah, it's a democracy, equal.
Yeah. But you've put it together. It's not like you were brought in to the band, I guess.
Right. Correct. Yes.
As with some of your other projects. Mm-hmm. So this album, actually, Place of Growth, I was hoping we could include, there's so many beautiful tracks, but maybe Shallows or Antelopen?
Sure. Yeah. That'd be great.
This is Antelopen from Hocktail's album, Place of Growth. Thank you.
And you guys also have an amazing new album with Vasen, and I'm not sure how they say their name.
Vasen?
Vasen?
Like the closest I can get to saying it right.
The very first episode of this podcast, 2021, was with a nickel harpa player, Kirsty Money, up here in Canada.
Cool.
So when your album came out, I think I saw her post first. Like, everyone go out and buy this album. It's so fantastic.
Oh, that's so nice. Yeah, we are so excited to get to do that. I still, it's like I have to pinch myself a little, but that happened. It's definitely like a teenage dream to get to play with those guys.
It's such a beautiful sound on the album with the combined bands. And I also noticed that they got, you know, funding money from Sweden, the Swedish government, for touring and making the album, which I get the feeling is less available in the States. Like, I'm in Canada. I think we might have a little more government support for that.
Definitely. Yeah. There are some, like, nonprofit agencies, though, that do their part, like Club Passim. They have some funds. You know, there is some stuff out there. Whippoorwill Arts. It's just, not through the government.
Mm-hmm. So are you guys touring that project at all?
Like, we have been. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're going to do a handful more shows this year, but we did a bunch. We did a West Coast tour, Midwest, East Coast, Sweden. We're going to play at Celtic Connections over in Scotland in January, and then the Savannah Music Festival in April. That's all that's on the books yet, but probably a couple more things.
So the Punch Brothers, are you guys still active?
Yeah, we've been doing a podcast, actually, on Audible. That was the bulk of what we did last year.
Okay.
So it's kind of like, if you ever listen to the Live From Here radio show, it's similar to that in that it's a musical variety show, but it has this frame where it takes place in the near future. So there's some, like, comedy skit kind of stuff around that. And that was just released in October, the first 8 episodes that we made last year in New York, and we're about to do a second season of that.
I did not know about that project. That's very cool.
Yeah, it's called the Energy Curfew Music Hour.
Okay, we'll be linking that in the show notes.
Cool.
And whose idea was it to do that project?
Chris Thiele.
Okay.
Yeah. And his wife, Claire Coffey, and Noam Pekelny, the banjo player in the band, they're the writers for the show, and then we're like the house band, and then there's all these various musical guests, my favorite being James Taylor.
Okay, very fun.
Yeah.
And you guys won a Grammy for folk music, All Ashore. Were you in the band for that recording?
No, I can't claim that.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a great record, though. I love those songs. We've been playing a couple things off of there. It's fun.
Hi, just a quick break from the episode. I'm sure that you'll also enjoy my conversations with Adam Hurt, Jane Rothfield, Joe K. Walsh, Martin Hayes, Tracy Silverman, Alexis Chartrand, Gina Burgess, and Guy Donis, to name a few. These are all linked directly to this one. It's a joy to bring these meaningful conversations to you, but this project costs me quite a bit of money and lots of time. Please support the series through either my merchandise store or buy me a coffee on my Ko-fi page. For the merch, it features a unique design by artist Steffi Kelly, and you can browse clothes, stickers, notebooks, water bottles, and more, everything printed on demand. You'll also find the link to sign up for my newsletter, where you'll get access to exclusive information about upcoming guests. Please check out my back catalog, with episodes going back to 2021. Now back to Brittany.
So what was it like joining that band?
Well, to be perfectly honest, like, the main descriptive word like that comes to mind is stressful because I mean, for a lot of reasons, partially because the music is really challenging, just very specific, in a way that's really cool for me to like get inside of and learn, because it's the kind of band where it has to be like exactly the right person, not just like somebody playing the guitar. It's like just so dialed in. Like, there's tunes where I'm like, wow, I'm not like bouncing my bow enough to like get the like rhythmic effect needed for this moment. You know, it's just like, it's really dialed in. And they've been together for 18 years. So there's a lot of history there in terms of like how they're working together, as well as like the music that they've created together. So it just feels like a very large thing to jump into. And Gabe's amazing. I love his fiddle playing. So there's also that. Like, and we're really different as players. So there's a lot for me to learn there. And yeah, it's just kind of daunting. And also like the way that the band works. But like just like I'm pretty used to like a folkier model where like we are our own managers and like maybe there's a booking agent at some point in the band's career, but like everything is very like homegrown and you feel like you have a lot more control over your schedule mm-hmm. and like kind of the decisions that are getting made. And that the Punch Brothers is really not like that. It's just more like of a machine that I'm stepping into where there's like a lot of people that are figuring stuff out, which is good and very helpful. But just a different dynamic in terms of figuring out how to get what I need from it.
I think it's just a reflection of different parts of the music industry.
Yeah.
You know, I'm in an orchestra and I have this incredible thing of a tenured job, right? Which is, mm-hmm. I'm not freelance, but I don't have control over my schedule at all.
Yeah. And I don't get word of what's happening like very quickly. So I don't like that part of it. It feels like it makes it a lot harder to do other things. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is what it is.
How about time to compose? Do you kind of schedule creative time that way?
Yeah, honestly, I've not ever been great at that in the past. It's been more like, oh, I need something for this, or I have a little nugget and I do have time to work on it. So I've never been like super prolific. But actually, funny you should ask that. Right now, I'm like, I have scheduled this time for myself to do exactly that. And that's the first time I've really been that conscious about doing it. And I'm really grateful to have that. And also time off the road. It's kind of like it's creative time, but it's also like rest time. So it's pretty great.
That is great. So when you moved to Nashville from Boston, I mean, I know there's a big studio scene there. Mm-hmm. Were there things that, like, unexpected experiences of living there?
I think, I mean, there's this whole, the scene of, like, the acoustic musicians, like the Sam Bush, kind of that crowd of people that just seem, like, very much larger than life to me, like, 10, 20 years ago. And then to just, like, be, like, now you see those people at the Station Inn and you're like, friends with them. Like, there's a interconnectedness, a kind of like knitted together scene of like these people as real humans, which is like really nice to just kind of be around. And yeah, I think when I first moved to town, I was dating somebody who was more in the like singer-songwriter scene, which I was not as familiar with then. It was kind of before that, like there'd been so much blending of this like Americana stuff. So it was cool for me to get a window into that world. And the thing that I thought was amazing, which maybe it is this way everywhere, but I think Nashville, because it's such a music town, there's so much stuff, so much industry happening around music. So there's actually quite a lot of opportunities. And it didn't feel competitive in the way that I would have assumed. Mm-hmm. It felt very supportive, like everybody's rooting for each other. They're helping each other out. They're playing in each other's bands. They're lending each other microphones. Like a lot of folks have like day jobs, like where they like park cars or serve at this restaurant or whatever. And the music is just like this fun thing that they connect over.
That's great.
Yeah.
Another one of your projects that's super interesting to me is with Lena Jonsson, the Swedish violinist. And you did a album with her like almost 10 years ago as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, we've done two now.
So The Snake, do you want to talk about that album?
Sure, yeah. It's sort of related to the like creative time thing as well, because so she and I had like become friends, really just kind of met and hit it off, had like a really similar kind of like approach to the fiddle, like ferocity and like just love for it and like wanting to play tunes all night long. Like we're similar in that way. She could definitely out party me, but so yeah, we just hit it off. We felt really similar. We made that record, did some gigs, and then like time happened and like she started her band, I was doing Hocktail. We kind of just got busy doing other things and we hadn't played together in a long time. And she's always been really good about visiting the States, like because she studied at Berkeley for two semesters. So she has a lot of American friends, and she had this other band called the Goodbye Girls with three Americans. So she comes over a lot, basically. And she was like, hey, can I come visit this time? And I was like, yeah, you know, that would be great. Like, she's so good at writing. Like, she's quick and just kind of like on the ball. Like, I'm gonna make another record. Here we go. Here's the tunes. So I thought having her around and like to do that together would be really fun. So basically that's what we did. And we didn't even say like, we're going to make another album. We just said like, let's write tunes together. And so we did that for about a week, and then we just set up microphones and made that album.
Great. Yeah. And how does she pronounce her name?
Again, it's like really hard for me to actually do it, but Lena Jonsson.
Okay.
But whenever people say, is your name Lena or Lena? She always says, yes.
Yeah. And I thought it's interesting. You have three tunes on there inspired by Bach. There's one, there's the valse. Mm-hmm. Could we include that?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
You're about to hear Lot after Bach, Valse, from The Snake with Lena Jonsson.
We talked a little bit about your classical training, exploring different styles. Do you play jazz at all, or have you studied jazz?
A little bit, yeah. I studied a little bit of gypsy jazz when I was a teenager. Daryl always was like exposing me to jazz and teaching me some of the theoretical stuff. I never got really deep into it. It always felt like a little like out of reach, but also like not of my primary interest. I think I had enough other interests. And it's still kind of like, it's like a little bit further away. But I mean, I really do enjoy it. And I think I've been exposed more lately and listened to more. Like, because it's sort of like you're not going to ever learn anything if you don't listen to it, you know, so you have to actually like it enough to do that. And I've been, it's a slow process, but I'm, you know, I have my like real book over there. I was reading it last night.
Well, I've just, you're such a fantastic player, and it just seems to me there's so much room. Like, you know, you're so young and you started so young. So I was thinking maybe she'll go in that direction. Who knows?
Yeah, it could happen. I mean, there's so much like amazing chordal just richness there that I would love to mine and like use more in writing.
Yeah. And teaching, I noticed you're doing artist works, which mm-hmm. is a pretty good online platform. So do people, they actually send you these feedback videos?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they so I have all the lessons up there. They can watch anything in whatever order they want, and then they send me a video of whatever they're working on, which can be something they've learned from me, or it can be just something that they have and they want to show. And it's usually from anywhere from like 3 to 10 minutes long. And then I watch the videos, and then I get to respond to them with comments. It's a really fun process, actually. Like, as much as I am kind of wary of the whole online teaching thing, because it is just better to be in a room with somebody and play with them, it's a pretty good format. I think it works well. And I learn a lot from getting to see different people. And like, I used to be very reticent to say anything about technique, because I did have good technique training, but then I kind of like, not totally on purpose, threw it all out the window and just did what worked for me. So I never wanted to tell people what to do, because a lot of the times I'm not even doing that thing that I know you're supposed to do.
What kind of things?
Like mostly posture, I guess. Mm. Or like drawing the bow really straight. Like I'm like, oh, you're supposed to do it like this, and like it's parallel the whole time. And then when I'm like saying that and making a video, I'm like, I'm not doing it. Like, I've just done things without thinking about what they were for so long that things kind of drift in a certain direction sometimes. And then suddenly you don't have perfect technique anymore. Not that I ever did, but yeah. And I think I just try to be honest about that. Just say like, here's something that like, this is what you're supposed to do, and these are the reasons why you're supposed to do it, and then do with it what you will. And I think also, like, as I get older, I'm like starting to have physical issues, you know, which that was never a thing before. So I didn't really think about the whole, you know, how your technique works. It's made to work and like make sure you don't get injured. So when things start going wrong, that's a good time to like really examine your technique.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting to me, as I've been playing almost 50 years, because I started when I was 6. Wow. And I'm gonna be 56 soon. And things that didn't used to be a problem became a problem at a certain point in my career. Mm-hmm. That I just kind of unexpected, but it's good. And it helps my teaching, because then you're like, oh, this is something I need to address regularly because it's become this problem.
Yeah, I taught a workshop recently at this festival in Canada, and somebody asked a question about something, and I kind of got off on this thing about, like, you know, looseness and, like, how you hold it and stuff, and they were like, wow, like, nobody ever talks about this. You should talk about this in every workshop, like, just, like, thinking about how you're holding things and, you know, how you're sitting and all of that. It's, like, it's really so important.
Yeah. Was that in Chelsea, Quebec?
Mm-hmm. Because
that's right near where I live. And I
no
just
way.
Yeah, but I noticed it, I think, the day of, and of course it was sold out, that you and Natalie were doing this festival up here.
It was so delightful. You should try to go next year. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a cool community. You probably know those folks.
I don't. I mean, I'm not in the traditional music scene.
Okay.
And it is sometimes surprising to me. And I've interviewed a lot of jazz musicians all over, but also from this area. And there's people I met in my city that I just never knew because I wasn't crossing paths with them until mm-hmm. I started doing the podcast. So that was kind of cool. Yeah. Well, touring, we talked about being on the road a lot. Do you have helpful habits?
No, it's the short answer, but I'm working on it. I've been on tour with people that do have really helpful, healthy habits. Like taking a run every morning or something like that. I think it's been hard for me to like figure out how to prioritize all the things, especially when you're in like what I was talking about before about the sort of folky homegrown thing. Like it can really be easy to have all the time get eaten up because you're either on the way to the gig, you know, rehearsing, sound checking, trying to eat, trying to play the show, trying to sell the merch, trying to talk to everybody, packing the car, like visiting with your hosts, like having breakfast with your host the next morning, or like trying to see your friend that because you're passing through their town. Like the time can very easily all be spoken for and you haven't exercised or you haven't meditated or whatever. So I think it's really mostly about like boundaries, which I feel like it took me a really long time to arrive at that need in my late 30s, but now knowing that that's really important, and that even if you might feel like you're missing out on something or letting somebody down, it can be okay, because it has to be, because you have to do what works for you.
Yeah. I was wondering about you talking to audience members after shows. That must be hard sometimes to just...
Yes and no. I mean, it's also like really energizing and sweet, and sometimes it makes the connection feel more palpable. Like, I mean, I think you can feel that while you're on stage sometimes, but also with different audiences, people respond differently, so you're not always like so sure what they think about it. But then getting to like visit one-on-one can be really sweet. So I actually really like doing that. Like, so, I mean, sometimes people come up and they, I don't know, like it can be draining sometimes, but a lot of it I find very positive. And like meeting young people or, you know, things like that are pretty great.
What are the audiences like for Americana in, like, let's say Europe? I don't know if you've toured in Asia. I was kind of curious about those different scenes.
I was in Japan when I was really young with my orchestra, and then I was in China, but I was kind of mostly tagging along on this. It was one of those State Department tours with Abigail Washburn, her band. So I can't really speak to those audiences, but in Europe, I would say it's like not that different from over here. People are pretty excited. There's a range of like how much they show it. I think Americans are like maybe the highest on that, like just like clapping and like wooing and stuff, but that's not true everywhere either. It's like kind of a, can be a local culture thing, I think, as well. In Germany, they like clap. They're really like rhythmic. I don't know. It's different everywhere.
And how about women in bluegrass? Because it seems like it's pretty male-dominated.
Yes and no. I think the tides are really turning now, I think, in a bigger way. I feel that that's like the momentum has been reached, or whatever you call that. Like, yes, yeah. like there used to be like very few, and you're like, okay, that is the one role model doing that thing. But now it's a lot. It's a lot of women, and... think that that's helpful, because then young girls see that and they feel like they can go for it too. Bluegrass is really interesting, like culturally, where it's coming from, and it's okay. Look, I guess I should just speak to my experience, because that's all I can really do. It's not that helpful to think about it all the time, but I do think about it a lot. And I think that's because I've been in like situations with people that I know very well and adore. And it's very much like, it becomes like family, but there's still like a dynamic that's difficult because I'm a woman. Or just because I'm me, actually. Like, I think I have to be open to that possibility too, but it's like not necessarily a gender thing. It's just like how you interact, but like society like affects that, obviously. I think it can be really tiring to like sort of fight some of those things, those expectations and those ways that people are used to interacting. And I think I kind of realized this recently, that like a lot of the women, a lot of my like peers and like, you know, people in a similar like musical place to me, but like, basically these people, rather than like being in a band with a bunch of boys, they often like lead the band. And that like creates a different dynamic. And I don't know, you should ask like a band leader female if that is even true, but I kind of like realized that recently, like that would be easier like in some ways, but like obviously not easier in other ways, because you're leading a band and that's really hard to do, but like kind of setting up that dynamic from the outset rather than being an equal and sort of having to fight for your equality.
And is that musically too, because the bluegrass is really about solos?
Totally, yeah. There's so much like testosterone just built in there, I think.
Yeah.
And you kind of have to like sign up for that, I guess, if you want to be in there, you know? I think that was something I used to think about a lot, like, because there would be those moments where, like, certain people get passed over in a jam. And it's not just, like, women or whatever. It's, like, they just think you're, like, not gonna do it or whatever. Like, that happens sometimes. Or people decline. They say, like, oh, I'm too scared to take a solo or whatever. And so I think I was always, like, there's not a girl in this jam. Or, like, I'm not gonna not take a solo just because I don't know this tune. Like, I am gonna, like, fight for my spot here because I think that is what is right. And I was like, not like militant about it, but it was like important to me to like show up there and like represent womankind. But at a certain point you have to just like do something because you want to do it. And then there's the whole thing about like if you're gonna have children and how that stratifies the music world. Mm-hmm. And not to say that it can't be done, because I have a lot of like peers that are doing that in their own way. There's many different ways, but I think that's just like a large thing that women have to contend with if they're being professional musicians.
Yeah, I think in the jazz world as well, like the late nights and the touring and very male dominated until recently too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was thinking maybe we could talk about some of your fun gigs. I noticed like you did some late night TV, like with Steve Martin. Was one of your mm-hmm. your gigs?
Yeah, that was really fun. That was when I was playing with Tony Trischka. He and Steve had a double banjo thing, and I got to play on one of Steve Martin's albums, which was great. I love his tunes. Like, he's a great musician. Yeah, just kind of a wild window into that TV world.
Yeah. And you do play banjo as well.
Yeah, I play some banjo. I that was because of my obsession with Bruce Molsky. It was like, I want to be just like him and play all the instruments. And banjo is a really fun one. And the banjo-fiddle connection in old-time music is a pretty special thing. Just like all the rhythm there. It's a cool instrument.
Yeah, I listened to your album Impromptu Sessions, which is all old-time banjo.
Cool. Yeah, that was a... well, impromptu thing. And it was kind of like, oh, I would like to release some music into the world. And that felt easier, I guess, or like more fun to me at the time than trying to make a fiddle record. It's just like, these are tunes that I like, and I'm going to play them in this setting that feels special and fun. Yeah.
I interviewed Adam Hurt for this podcast.
Cool.
People listening probably know who he is, but old-time banjo, also fiddler, and he plays gourd banjo, so we got into that. And what I found interesting is that he really only plays traditional music. He doesn't write any music. He feels like that's plenty.
Mm-hmm.
And then other people I've talked to, like Jane Rothfield and other people, Joe K. Walsh, are like, you know, that's good, but of course writing music. But you're more of the camp of let's create something new out of these old traditions.
I really love both parts. I think they're both important. I think you can put your own spin on it without writing something new. I think I've fought against, or I don't know, I've like not known how to conceive of that for a while, and like always thought there's just like artists like create something new or whatever, but I think that's kind of bullshit. Like, you know, you can be artistic in whatever way you choose, and no one of those things is like more valid than the other.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a classical musician, and it's all about, you know, some of my friends have said, really, we're recreating. It's never going to be the same every time.
Yeah, interpreting. Yeah, and that's so cool to just be creating experiences like that.
And I wanted to ask you, can we include a little bit of that banjo album for people to hear?
Yeah, sure. Totally.
Yeah, I was reading a review somebody had written on Bandcamp, and they're like, I didn't know it was a banjo album until I bought it, because it was Brittany Haas, and then I was like, pleasantly surprised. It was great.
Yeah, it's definitely like rough around the edges, but it was really fun, and it was my two good friends that I was spending a lot of time with during the pandemic, and they're both great bass players who like really occupied different realms.
Mm-hmm. This is Lost Girl from Impromptu Sessions number 1. With Brittany Haas on banjo. So how about memorizing tunes? Has that always been easy for you?
I think it used to be easier. And then now it takes a little longer for something to stick. And then I think I've also, like, because I can read music, sometimes I'll just learn things that way and then it doesn't kind of get into the same long-term memory area. And I guess I'm just doing it a little less lately. That used to be such a huge part of how I spent my time. But yeah, I mean, I love that. Like in an old time jam, that's one of my favorite things. Like I don't like leading tunes because I always want to like play something that I don't know yet.
Okay.
And like kind of like hone in on the details of the person that's leading it, you know, because it just feels like a fun way to get outside of yourself. Mm-hmm.
Now you mentioned Bruce Molsky a few times, one of your mentors, and I know you've played with him. Mm-hmm. What did you get out of working with him or from him, his mentorship?
So much. He's such a great player. He's really, I mean, like Adam Hurt, like really taken traditional music and made it his own. I think he's just like a consummate musician and performer and so thoughtful with his repertoire and how he puts on a show. And how he connects to the music as well. He's also a great teacher, and I think he, like, his whole thing about, you know, being like an outsider, but respecting the tradition so deeply that you can really enter that world and, like, do right by it. That's an important lesson for anybody who plays traditional music. I mean, it's different if you like grow up in it, but if you just come to it and you just love it, like how do you do that?
Mm-hmm. So we talked a little bit about other creative outlets, gardening and stuff. Do you have other things, like now that you're trying to find more balance and be more of a homebody when you're home?
Mm-hmm. I find that like trying to write words is helpful for like processing emotions. So I've been doing a little bit of that, like whether it's just like prose or little songs. Haven't done much in like the visual arts, but I love just like being, I really like being outside and like hiking and walking in nature and like observing animals and stuff like that. Which is not necessarily like a creative pursuit, but it feels like it gives me something really important. I read a lot of Pema Chodron books in the last year, and I really love that. And I'm not meditating often, but like that's something that I want to do more of, and I feel like I have a lot to learn from Buddhist ideas.
And finally, do you have upcoming projects this year you want to talk about?
So a bunch of stuff with Punch Brothers, which is, yeah, that's kind of like the bulk of the stuff, like schedule-wise anyways, the podcast. And then that being a vehicle for new music with that band, as well as like really getting more solid with the whole back catalog. We're going to do some touring. And then some more stuff with my sister. I'm hoping that we're going to make another album soon. We're working on it. And yeah, beyond that, I'm not so sure. I'm kind of leaving the rest of it open instead of trying to fill every moment. But yeah, I would like to make another album of my own music at some point, whatever that looks like. It's like the kind of thing where I like don't even want to say it out loud because then I have to do it.
Okay, yeah. Wonderful. Well, thanks so much for this today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's really nice talking to you.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please share this with your friends and check out episodes you may have missed at leahroseman.com. If you could buy me a coffee to support this series, that would be wonderful. Or you can browse the collection of merch with a very cool, unique, and expressive design from artist Steffi Kelly with notebooks, mugs, shirts, phone cases, and more. I'm an independent podcaster, and I really do need the help of my listeners. All the links are in the show notes. Have a wonderful week.